Accession number 31693, reel 18.
Mr. Robson, reel 18. So, in addition to crossing rivers and of course taking on this equipment that you're talking about, what other training? You mentioned patrolling. What was the training element in that?
Once we'd finished our initial jungle training, i.e., we're doing our own bits of training. This is the signals. We would be taught how to put up a bed, for instance, in the jungle, because it's not a case of just lying down, because you've got to remember there are poisonous, like the snakes, the scorpions, so you've got to make sure that when your jungle boots, when you took your jungle boots off at night, and again, different altogether. Because when you went out with your patrol gear and another set of gear, a dry gear, which you got changed into on a night time before you went to sleep. Now, remembering out in the jungle, it gets dark very, very quick. Of course, when you went out on patrol, you would take out a spare shirt, spare pair of trousers, spare socks. You keep the weight down to a minimum anyway, and your plimsolls. And on a night time, you will get changed in after your meal, after you'd stood down, because you always stand to on a night time. But you'd always have your meal as well before dark, because if you wanted a hot meal, you had the little stoves you used to make your meal on. You would have to make sure that you had the meal, and then after that it was a case of getting changed after you were stood down, getting into what they call your dry gear, and you go to bed on the night, and you would sleep until first light. Before first light, you would about an hour before first light, you would be woken up. You would be stood to, but you would get out. You and I used to hate it with a vengeance, getting out of this dry gear which you'd been in your lightweight sleeping bag, and putting on wet socks, wet underpants, wet top, wet trousers, because it was always cold, but you're always hunging up outside, because you'd make a little cover as well, because it always rains in the jungle on a night, and you put all your wet gear on, and you'll be surprised how cold it gets after putting this stuff on. And you were stood too as a signaller. I wouldn't be actually in the defensive positions. I'd be in the centre of the patrol, and obviously make sure that the radio equipment was working all right. And when you opened up the radio was on all the time. It was a case of you would speak softly and quietly into the radio. Sound carries a long way in the jungle, and as does smell. So you put all this equipment together, and then first light, when there was no sign of any attack, then you would get your breakfast ready. Being a signaller, the platoon sergeant would always do my meal, because I would be busy the radio communications and everything else, and I'd be there all the time, and invariably the platoon sergeant, again depending on which platoon, some platoon sergeants didn't, but a lot did, and they would take your breakfast off your, on a night time before you make, they would do the meal after you'd done all these other duties, remembering that once you went into a patrol position or a league position, all the sentries would be put out and he'd be doing that. I'd be doing the radio communication side of things, and it was, shall I say, interesting. I enjoyed it, to be fair. At the time, I think I did more as a signaller. I think I did more patrols than any other signaller in the battalion. One of my, I think, forties was, I was a fairly good HF operator, high in Morse and everything. And I did quite a number, but that, this is later on, this when we went on, into, yeah, into action. Yeah. But yes, so we learned all those type of things. And of course, we also had our sports as well. It wasn't all work. And this we had...
Big, this was a big camp, was it, in the training camp?
Oh, the training camp was massive.
And was it permanent?
It was a permanent camp. And they also had, down at the bottom end, a cemetery. Neil Old Gurkhas. Because the Gurkhas had been there for a long time. And there was a Gurkha cemetery. I remember going down and having a look at the Gurkhas who had been buried there. So all the Gurkhas weren't actually buried in Singapore. There was a cemetery at Paradise Camp.
The food that you, again, in the patrol situation and in this training situation, were you being what, weaned onto sort of jungle food for the want of a better term, jungle rations, anything like that?
We'd been used to the old rations with the tin, the old 24-hour ration packs. And of course, when you were going on a patrol for 4 and 5, 6 days, you couldn't carry all this tin stuff. So we were issued with the dried stuff, which had to be made up with water. You always carried, when you went out on patrol, even during the training, you had 100 rounds of ammunition. Although my personal weapon was a Sterling submachine gun, I must admit I felt safer with the SLR. It was a 7.62mm weapon, good stopping weapon, although it was heavy, especially with a signaller, because signallers, we always had the most equipment. Each signaller had exactly the same as a rifleman, but we had a 45-pound radio on our back. When I say a 45-pound the radio and the battery that was encased in the radio was a total of 45 pounds. And batteries, the annual life used to last anywhere between, if you had a good batch, 16 hours. A bad batch, 8 hours. And again, it depends on where the batteries have been stored prior to how long they've been made. So what we had to do as signallers, remembering that if we went out for 4 days, we always had to take another 2 day supply. And that included food as well.
And this was carried on your back?
This was carried on our back.
Quite a what total weight would you be carrying with your weapon and everything else?
With weapon, that's why we only ever took one change of clothing. The reason for comfort. So I would say weight wise, you'd be talking in the region of about. So with food, ammunition, and everything else, I would say you would be talking somewhere in the region of 70-80 pounds, especially if you had the SLR, which is a heavy weapon, and of course you carried five magazines, one magazine on your rifle, and four magazines in your pouches, plus all the other equipment, your food, all your radio equipment. So the batteries, you would actually spread out amongst the patrol. And a lot of them, the patrol, you know, is, oh, do I have to? But I said, if you want communications, if you want mortar cover coming down, or air cover if we get ambushed, I need someone else. I said, I can't carry all of it, because the batteries are heavy enough as it is, and because they were quite bulky. And I said, if you need them, I said, we need them. So it used to be spread out amongst the patrol, and you would always get somebody coming along, and are you ready to change your battery yet, or will you take my battery first, you know. So yeah, it was quite funny on that way. But when we went out with the A13s, which was the HF radios, the batteries there, they were rechargeable and they were expensive. And if you lost the one, you would pay for it. And they were quite expensive. And when you spread them out, I mean, yes, they were rechargeable, but you still had to have spares. And the guy would say, well, can I throw this away when you use it? I said, no, you can't throw it away. That's rechargeable, and I've got to take them back.
So it was quite a load, you know, like First World War, you know, loads on the backs of the infantry and so on.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Right. It's the same when you go out on patrol. You always go as fast as the slowest man. And the slowest man was the radio operator, because he carried more equipment than anyone else. And I remember my first patrol, I didn't... we had Arbalite rifles as well. Still as a machine gun, it was all right, but... everybody else had the Armalite rifle, which was a lot smaller than, a lot lighter, was the American Armalite than the SLR. Of course, still a submachine gun. If I wanted ammunition, I was the only one carrying a 9mm. So once you run out of that ammunition, you ain't got any more. So I didn't like taking the Sterling submachine gun. I preferred the Armalite for the lightness. But not everyone was issued with an Armalite rifle. So my personal weapon was an SLR. When I went out on patrol, I would go in and change my SLR to the Armalite, which was all the patrol were issued with Armalites.
Do they take a bayonet? Was it a bayonet?
Oh yes, we always took a bayonet with us. Not only did we take a bayonet, we also took what they call a gullock. A gullock is a long knife for cutting down anything that was in your way. They were good, but the problem with the gullock was they were razor sharp, and I don't know what it was, but we had a lot of accidents with the gullocks. People you'd hit a tree, and these gullocks wouldn't touch them. And they would bounce off and cut a guy. That was how sharp they were. So yeah, it was. So yes, we had a bayonet and we had the gullock.
Did you, mentioning the fact that you could have accidents in the patrol situation we're talking about, what about first aid kit then? Was that carried by each man or...?
All we carried, you know, obviously you had a first aid guy there, but each member of the patrol, every guy in the patrol, always carried what they call a first aid dressing, and that was normally carried on the front of your weapon, on by the shoulder harness. And all it was a little bit of tape, and it was actually stuck on there. So it was handy. So if anybody did get shot, you didn't have to hunt for it. It was there in front of you. But I mean, nowadays when you look at what the guys have got, the first aid equipment, ours was really very, very basic. It was just an ordinary shell dressing. And all that did was you just put it on a wound and tied it on, and that was it. I mean, they weren't that good. And thinking back, I'm trying to think how long I had that. I had it a long time, because we always had them.
Movement in the patrol situation, what was the method of movement of the general?
When you moved, you would have... We had IBAN trackers. They would always be up front with the first. Again, these guys were chosen who would be lead patrol, and you would always leave a decent gap. When I say a decent gap, you would keep the guy in front of you in sight, but far enough away that if you had a if you ran into an ambush, a burst of machine gun fire would reduce the casualties because you weren't close up, and you were always aware, and you would always be looking. Even as a signaller, you would be watching on the right, on the left, man behind you, man in front of you. You would have to be aware of where the next man was in case of ambush. And of course, in case of ambush, always got off the track. We try not to use tracks where possible, but obviously you've got to use tracks, and you've got to be aware of where you're putting your feet as well, because we did have guys. Not our battalion, we were quite fortunate, but the battalion we took over from, which was the Green Jackets, we had a guy who had his foot blown off from a mine which had been placed on a track. And when there was a way of, if there was a tree across the track, you'd be aware of where you put your feet. You didn't just stand on the log and jump down, because that weight could actually trigger off a jump, what we used to call jumping jacks. And I think that was the one thing I was aware of, and not being afraid but concerned about, because the jumping jacks, they were, if I remember rightly, they were Czechoslovakian mine, and the anti-personnel mine, and it was on a spring, and if you stood on it, it would jump up and it would catch your midriffs, and it would blow. I mean, you might be lucky, it might not be you that get it, it might be the guy who's behind you. Fortunately, as I said, you keep far enough behind a person, or far enough in front of a person, that if it did get a one, then of course that you didn't get hit with a one. You had to beware of booby traps. It's well known now, the Viet Cong used them, and so did the Indonesian forces. They would use punji stakes. They would pits, and you know, not on the track itself, but ambush you, and you would run off, and you could fall in a pit. And in the pit would be bamboo stakes, and there the bamboo stakes would be smeared with human excretion. And there was all these things that you had to be aware of, and of course the old snakes. But a snake would always get away from you. It would hear you coming, so it would disappear. So although a lot of people had fear of snakes, snake would get away. It was scorpions that you had to be careful of, because you get a bite from a scorpion, you know about it.
Were there other creatures that were
centipedes? I've never seen centipedes as big. And they were poisonous as well. And there was various other things, but centipedes and stuff like that. But these centipedes had a nasty bite.
So you'd have to be careful, particularly on the morning, changing your clothes.
Getting back into your clothes. What you used to do, you always used to shake them first, make sure nothing got them. But you always hung them up anyway. You would never ever be anything on the ground. Similarly, any stuff that we used, not so much if we were further back, but certainly one on the border, you never ever left any waste. You never left any rubbish. You would carry all your rubbish back with you. So when you were up on there, you weren't allowed to smoke anyway. And you weren't allowed to cook. The dried meals that were had, you could actually eat them, you know, and drink the water.
What were they exactly?
The dried meals. Oh, there was everything. A steak. You know, when you could cook, you would pour the water in, you put it in, you would break it down. And it would be a nice mince. Apple flakes was a favourite with the guys. It was all dried stuff, but when you added water to it,
they were in small plastic bags.
Yeah, of course you had your hexamine and everything else. You know, when you had a meal, but as I say, once you got onto the border, you would never ever cook. You wouldn't smoke. You wouldn't wash. You wouldn't shave. So yeah, but that's all came when we went down into Sarawak and went.
So bearing in mind what you faced when you went to Borneo, was the training good? Did it prepare you well?
I thought the training was excellent. It did. As I say, we used to go out and do our own little patrols. It was a safe area, so we'd go out and I'd lead my section out. We used to do our own like section patrols but I remember we had our laughs as well, because I remember being chased on two occasions. We would go out on the patrol. I'd have my radio on my back. I'd be the section leader, the section commander, and we'd go out. And one of the guys in the front actually disturbed a hornet's nest. Now, hornets are massive, and when you get chased by a hornet, you know about it. And we hadn't been far from the river. And these hornets attacked us. Even though I had a radio on my back, I was still the first one down the river. And we had radio on our back, and as we got to the river, the radio came off, and we jumped in the river, all of us, with our weapons as well, and ducked under the river until the hornets disappeared. There was another time. We were going through, and they had these massive buffaloes, the water buffaloes. Now, contrary to what people think, they can move fast. And again, we got chased by these buffaloes, water buffaloes. And they can move, because we weren't deep in the jungle, we were in secondary jungle. There was kampongs by, you know, so there were people in there, there was locals. And honestly, these buffaloes can move. But we ran faster. Just get away. And as I say, I had the radio on my back and I still beat my boys.
How long did the training last?
We finished our training just before Christmas. Just before Christmas.
This was
65. And we did our relaxation, we did our football training, we were allowed out to the local village for a drink, and that's unfortunately where myself and like Norman Dawes, we went to promote, we went to celebrate his promotion with a little Titchy Teasdale and then another guy, and ended up Norman got locked up, and I got charged as well, along with the two private soldiers, like called Mitchison and Titchy Teasdale and Norman. We went down into for company commander's orders, and I thought I was going as a witness, but unfortunately I wasn't. I was charged as well, and we were remanded for CO's orders. The company commander, Johnny Grosh, a South African, lovely fella, and the Sergeant Major, Bellringer, said, "Can't do nothing about it, Corporal Robson. I've been told I can't deal with it. I've got to remand you for commanding officer's orders." And that was the first time I'd ever been on CO's orders, very first time. And I went in front of the CO, and was reduced to the rank of private, along with Norman Dawes. He hadn't even had his up 24 hours, and he got busted. And the two private soldiers, they got fined £10 each. And I think that was when my shall I say, I had a breakdown in communications with my platoon commander after that.